expenses in turn offering certain choices. And the principal choices in each case are the choice of acceptance and the choice of rejection. And when experience is accepted, we move forward. When it is rejected, we start over again, because we will continue until it is accepted. If we accept, therefore, a universal principle and recognize that this universe, with its infinite magnificence, in which minute forms of life indescribable are perfectly ordered, vast orbits of universal motion without exception fulfilling their destinies, that everywhere the marvel of universal architecture in the form of the cell and the structure of minute sea creatures, the tremendous architecture of mountains and valleys, the blazing radiance of suns, the tremendous marching symphony of galaxies, all of these things are either ordered or they are not ordered. And we cannot look upon the universe. We cannot watch the calendar. We cannot observe the orderly sequences of the days and nights and months and years and centuries. We cannot measure the precessions of the equinoxes or contemplate the phenomenon of the tides without being instinctively aware that we are in a universe ruled by facts, ruled by common sense, and ruled by principles that are not only enduring, but by their very nature have to be meaningful. And this meaning for man can only be one possible meaning. There is only one excuse for suffering, for living, for existing, for passing through the infinite concatenations of youth and maturity and age. There can only be one reason, and that is man is supposed to grow. That he is to mature something. That he is to achieve some greater knowledge or consciousness in himself than he might otherwise possess. That this consciousness or knowledge cannot be conferred vicariously even by God, but must be experienced by the living thing so that it becomes his own. And that this experience has as its ultimate, as indicated by the truly great whom we have known in life and in history, has its ultimate in the production of the individual who is enlightened, who accepts, who is a patient, who is wise, and who is in all things as good as human nature can be. So nature is producing better human beings out of insight, out of experience. And through experience, man has his magnificent opportunity to grow and become a truly perfect creature in this world of which he is a part. So philosophy insists upon this basic realization. And also that there is in nature a law relating to causes and their effects. That everything in nature has to be exhausted in its causes before its effects can cease. And that each effect may lead to further causes by a process called in Buddhism the Nidanas. In this process, each of us, in solving a problem, creates a new one. In attaining a certain level of insight, becomes immediately responsible for the attainment of a further level. Thus, nature is everywhere operating with justice. And justice means always that good must be rewarded, and that the works of evil must be corrected, and that the individual who, through ignorance or through perversion, betrays the laws of the universe of which he is a part, or violates them in his own action, this individual must be corrected. And correction must be impersonal, universal, and inevitable. And to achieve this, the universe has set into every pattern of existence its own consequences, so that a thing done inevitably produces a result like itself. For this result comes from itself. It is not bestowed upon it arbitrarily by some judge in space. All things have their own consequences within them. And when we set these actions in motion, their reactions are similarly vitalized and become immediately and inevitably associated with their corresponding actions. Consequently, the history of man is the history of man's motion from one problem to another, and the times in which he has evaded solution or has corrupted solution, and these times have in turn been followed by periods of affliction and adversity in which the very things he did produced their harvest in their own likeness, and the man who enjoyed the deed did not enjoy the reaction that resulted therefrom. Philosophy, therefore, invites us to investigate the nature of action in order that we may not at any time set in motion actions the consequences of which are difficult or impossible for us to sustain. Thus we have this pattern moving us and moving with us through the mystery of space. There was never a time in which we needed to have an intimate and rather friendly and loving relationship with space as we now need it today. For actually, these mysterious laws operating beyond us but also within us are the only hope we have. They are the justice which we seek in vain among the works of men. They are the eternal principles of honor, which cannot fail, even though the conduct of men may be dishonorable. And we must sometime make a choice, a very simple but direct one, as to whether we are willing to accept the universe and abide by its principles, or whether we shall go on rebelling and resenting and denying and criticizing and condemning. This decision is up to us. Now, if we decide to accept and take therefrom a certain natural strength, we observe that our psychic integration immediately improves. We are healthier and happier when we accept the best that we understand than we are when we resent the bad which we assume to exist. Now, we can say, for all practical purposes, that there are some pretty bad things that do seem to exist, and pretty hard to deny them. And we don't advocate shutting our eyes to these problems. But we do advocate the thinking through of them to the degree that the badness goes out of them. And we see in them rather challenge and opportunity, or are reminded of some basic error in our own judgment or conduct, so that we are grateful for an adversity rather than resentful of it. If we get the thinking straight, we can begin to recognize that we live in a universe that is amply able to take care of us, and that also in taking care of us, it will do that which we need, not that which we want. And in taking care of us, it may sometimes use extreme methods rather than to follow into the common, simple, happy ways that we would like to assume would represent parental indulgence. But actually, we are best taken care of when we permit the universe to do it and accept this care as we would the care of a loving parent, even though at a moment of punishment we may resent the parent. In the long run, we realize the wisdom of its actions, if these actions are wise. And in the case of this universal parent, an intelligence wise enough and great enough to create this mystery is wise enough and great enough to administer it in a reasonable way. With this kind of thinking, then, we can gradually learn to live with the bomb. We can learn to live with it, perhaps only because we have to. But this necessity does not necessarily mean that we will live with it well. It will not necessarily mean that we can give a good example to our children. So to this necessity must be added this internal enlightenment. To the necessity must also be brought the understanding, so that we are able to adjust ourselves to a slightly different degree of impermanence than we have ever known before, but a degree which is not unique in space, in no way different from any other kind of impermanence. In the fall of 1923, a great earthquake hit the Japanese islands. In this earthquake, if the truth were known, and I suppose the truth will never be known because of the conditions and the situation, I would suspect strongly that 250,000 died. We became duly and properly perturbed over this, and we rushed help to them, and we did all that we could to ease this situation. But this emergency was just as great as an emergency caused by a bomb. In the Lisbon disaster, more about 150 years ago or something like that, between 70 and 80,000 persons died in a few hours. There have been earthquakes in Asia, for example, that have shaken and torn to pieces areas larger than the United States in one quake. These things we call natural phenomena. And if villages and cities and towns are swallowed up, rivers are turned from their courses and inundate cities, or in another way, if cholera moves across Asia, as it frequently does, there have been years when cholera alone has taken 8 million lives. These things do not seem to frighten us so much. We don't want to be there when it happens. But it's a line or two in the newspaper underneath the football score. These things we take for granted. So that actually life to us subconsciously is not viewed as we consciously view it. Life to us is a perishable commodity. We know this, and we adapt to it in any way that we can. But the bomb is different. The reason why the bomb is different is because man is responsible for it, and he has the guilt of it on his own soul. He has no guilt for earthquakes. But with the bomb, he suddenly feels that he himself is destroying his own kind, that this whole thing is a sort of dishonorable suicide. This hurts him. It hurts him because man has always wanted to be regarded as the noblest of creatures. He likes to think he is far above the animal, far more advanced than primitive peoples, that he has a marvelous record of progress, and then crash, this thing explodes in his face, wiping away all his progress as far as its own psychic overtone is concerned. Perhaps we have to help man in this dilemma. Help him to realize that although he has done this thing, all he has really done is built another kind of a castle in a sandbox and knocked it down. That actually, just as surely as he has overestimated his attainments, now he overestimates his own destructiveness. But what can he destroy? Nothing that worms would not ultimately take away. Someone said not too long ago that there was a killer loose in the world that was more terrible than anything that we could command or imagine, and that this strange, insidious thing would, in the course of the next 100 years, take 3 billion lives. This killer is the death rate. We don't think about that too much, but we didn't create the death rate. It is this moral thing that has come down to hurt us. It is this thing within ourselves in which we suddenly stand face to face with a kind of savagery and become aware of the atavistic tendency of our own conscience and our own consciousness in its lowest and least unfolded condition. So now we have to live with these facts also. We have to live with a philosophy. And the philosophy tells us very simply that the reason why man could create the bomb is because man forgot. the most important part of his heritage, and that was the heritage of beauty and truth and love. That with all his haste and development, he considered canons to be practical and love a vanity of women. He considered good armament necessary, good ethics not necessary. And so by degrees he bound himself to the causes of death, feeling that if he could control life and death, he could control man. That the one threat he could hold over the head of any man is the threat of death. And that for most people, that threat would bring them to their knees. In the desperate effort to live, men would sell out everything that is real and valuable in life and simply cling with their fingers dug into the earth, cling for a little longer to this right to be physically alive. This was the power of death. This is the power of death that Jesus sought to tell us had no longer any authority. But we didn't understand. We didn't know the meaning of these words. We did not realize that death would be swallowed up in life. We were unable to orient these facts. Now, we've gone along and we've had a fairly successful century. We have made a lot of money. Look like stocks are picking up a little. But the rise in stocks isn't as cheerful as it used to be. I heard a man say yesterday, they're going up, but why? They're going up because it looks as though men would die. We're learning. And we have to learn a lot more. We have to learn the lesson that we refuse to learn in love. We have to learn this inevitable tragedy of the individual ignoring those values in his own consciousness which alone make him human. So if we can't do it, and if we won't do it, and we insist upon playing chess with human life, then we are breaking the rules. And it is necessary for us to discover the meaning of this in universal terms. But the fact that we may be seriously chastised for a very serious fault, because the universe has been more than patient with man. He has been a nuisance from the beginning. And many have regarded him as the most vicious parasite that was ever produced by nature. He has plundered everything and restored very little. He has given little of himself to the advancement of life, but has taken from life everything he could get. Nature says this isn't cricket. This is not the way it's done, my friend. You had all kinds of wars, massacres. You have seen tragedy, sickness, crime, and death, but you've done nothing about it. You've gone merrily on your way, saying to yourself, I can make a profit off of this war and it'll be fought somewhere else. Nature says this won't work. And so now we find a more severe evidence of our own mistake. Now, everyone is not involved in this mistake. Most people, as individuals, do not want to go to war. On the other hand, most people also in their various ways have been affected by this situation. War, in a little way, can be simply called selfishness, self-centeredness, unreasonable ambition, cutthroat competition in business, the desperate effort at status. All of these things are of the same essential substance as war. They are all wrong. They are all false, and they are all dangerous to the common good of man. So we are all to a measure tarred a little with the same brush, although in many ways we do not wish to believe that we are. If by any chance, and there will be a good many, we are not really in this classification. If, to the very best of our own knowledge and understanding, we have lived as good a life as we know how to live, how then shall we explain that we too may be within the dangerous area of fallout? How are we going to say that nature is going to be able to divide between the just and the unjust? How are we to assume that when one of these blasts go off, the worst will be near this to the center? We don't, because that may not be the place where the best or the worst can be found. There are those who, in case of atomic war, would die. There are those who would live. Which one would be in the more fortunate condition? How do we know? There might be some who would save what they are and lose what they have and would wish they were dead. But they will still live. There are others who may be snuffed out so instantaneously that they will be spared from 10 years of arteriosclerosis. Which of them is suffering the worst? How do we know? We know that one thing is true, that out of every 10 persons who might instantly be destroyed by a bomb, 3 would otherwise die of long, painful, lingering illnesses by natural causes. Who is being punished? How do we know? Might we not possibly suspect that the nature of the punishment involves very deeply and immediately the nature of the person upon whom the so-called punishment falls? The same destruction that will destroy the hope of one will release another from a tragic situation in which there is no hope. How do we know? The answer has to lie in the consciousness and the adjustment of the individual. And although many might perish in a single place, each will perish as an individual. Each as a consummation of a situation in life. Each according to the dictates of a pattern which they themselves have carried to some degree of maturity. There has to be some way in which this type of common disaster, like a natural disaster of equal magnitude, cannot be unjust. The only answer to this is that pain and pleasure, life and death, hope and fear, faith and doubt, all of these are as they are to the person himself. The individual who has attained insight, who is firm in his convictions, enlightened in his principles, like Socrates, faces death as the least important of all circumstances. It is not important to him. It is not important to him because he, first of all, has experienced beyond it. And to Socrates, it was more important to maintain the truth of a matter than it was to compromise that truth and walk free by the payment of a small sum of money. Socrates did not need to have died. But death was so unimportant to him that the fear of it, which controlled most of the men of Athens, did not touch him at all. Socrates could not have been injured by an atomic bomb. He could have been killed, but he could not have been injured. Nor could this thing have caused in him any unreasonable anticipatory apprehensions. He would not live in daily fear of what might happen, and by this very circumstance live so miserably that if it did not happen, he then had no reason for life at all. He would continue to do these things which he knew to be right. And the length of life was simply of no unusual concern to him. He might take what precautions he could. He might do everything reasonable. But he certainly would not have wasted 1 hour in fear of something which he did not believe, and which in his heart he knew was not true. That is, that he was destructible. If then the individual, under the pressure of this tension, begins to look around, he may find these very answers, which in due time will be the end of war. Because war is valuable only because it destroys. It destroys your enemy. If gradually we realize that this is not true, if gradually we come to know that the conqueror must live on and remember, that the individual who destroys must live with his own act into the futures beyond time, we might very well have peace in this world. But as long as we believe materialistically that we shall go quietly to sleep no matter how many we have murdered, we have no true moral pattern. We have no reason for either goodness or evil. But we do see considerable reason to do as we please. Thus our philosophy has to come to our help here. And our philosophy, which can be a little bit of Zen and a little bit of mysticism, a little bit of Greek thought, maybe a tiny touch of Taoism from China, we can slowly build up a tranquility within ourselves that enables us to live without being scarred, without having something of a sickness creep into our hearts by which all our values become pessimistic. In order really to live a critical, dissatisfied, antagonistic, disillusioned life, we have to be pretty poor in understanding of principles. We have to waste a lot of energy, and the chances are, the way we're functioning now, we will most of us die of acidosis before any bomb ever gets us. We are breaking down and breaking up. We are continually anticipating the worst, and we are living under nervous tension and stress, which is so acute that we become obnoxious to ourselves, our families, our friends, and even downright strangers. This is no answer. It is all part of this insecurity pressure that we have within ourselves. We call it anything we want to. We call it mature concern over serious matters. But there's nothing mature about it, and it is far more jitters than concern. It does not mean anything. It simply means that we have not the courage or the immediate insight necessary to go out and think the thing through straight. Now, there is always a very good possibility that there won't be any bombs fall. There's always the very good possibility that man's subconscious has already learned a little bit, and that nobody really wants to be the one to drop the first one. There might be also rather physical advantages in being cautious, because as these stockpiles rise, it becomes obvious that the destroyer must himself accept a tremendous attack of destruction from his adversary. The thing is sometimes regarded as a bit of a stalemate, and perhaps it will never happen that there will be an atomic war. This, again, points out that the greatest preventive power would be the gradual waking up of man to the magnitude of his own selfishness, his own stupidity. If he can awaken to what's wrong with him in time, he may save himself this entire terrible sequence. We sincerely and devoutly hope that he will be able to do so. But if he does so, it has to be because he makes some improvement in himself. He must understand more deeply. He must accept principles more honorably. And he must also stand by truth more firmly. He cannot achieve peace by selling out to the enemy, nor by compromise. His greatest hope of peace, the greatest chance that he has to live, is the fact that he is not afraid to die. This is his hope of life. This is the hope of an honorable peace. Because if fear comes in, then compromise goes with it. And on compromise, we can never have any security in this world. But our great hope is that by not being afraid, we can prevent that which we fear. Now, there is much to support the possibility of such a reaction. And certainly it is the best reaction that the individual himself can cultivate. We have to live with this. Now we've got to learn to live with it in a very beautiful manner. There was a case that a little bit on this order. It was a private problem, but it's not so far from it. Years ago, there was a very distinguished and cultured Japanese gentleman who had given his life very largely to beauty and to art and to literature and to culture. And one day he learned that he only had a few days more to live. He was an elderly man. A serious illness had invaded his body, and it was only a matter of days. So the last day of his life, he was assisted partly from his bed. They went down into another part of his house with the assistance of his family. And there, seated quietly on one of the mats of the floor, he gathered up the flowers for a flower arrangement. To him, this was the best way to go. That his last work here would be a labor of beauty. That he would find in the gentle peace of bringing beauty according to his concept of beauty. That he had the answer. And shortly after he finished the arrangement, he passed on. But his last expression in life was not fear, nor hate, nor anxiety, nor doubt, but the simple continuance of an act of beauty. This was the way he wanted to go. If our world would live more like that, it would not go. Because it is where the important values are that our security rests. And if each person in his own life held beauty more sacred than life, love to be greater and deeper and stronger than pain, quietly we would fulfill our various works and in our due time quietly depart. This is the way nature intended. But man, by false values, by constantly creating artificial things and becoming the slave of them, has lost these simple dignities that are important. So if we can strengthen our culture, if we can strengthen our lives, if we can find new resources, if we can say very honestly that how long we live is not very important, but how well we live is of the utmost importance, and begin to think on this level, we probably will have life given to us. There are many stories told of very sick people who have had a great driving purpose in life, something that needed desperately to be done. And in a wonderful way, most of these people were given the energy, the strength, and the time to accomplish this necessary thing before they went. And they went when the work was done. This power to endure until the work is done is also shared by races and by nations. Races and nations grow old and die also. or are absorbed into the currents of new peoples. But everything survives, it seems, as long as there is a work it must do, a purpose that is bigger than self. In this type of an emergency, therefore, when it is rather dangerous and painful to think about self, we have added inducements to live for larger purposes. We have more inducement than ever before to enrich this being in the body, so that if it goes and when it goes forth best prepared and equipped for an existence in space. For surely it will leave behind these things with which it is familiar, but the principles of life which it has absorbed and contemplated and built in as character, these are a heritage that will not fail. So what our atomic age is telling us in terms of philosophy is rather simple. It is simply telling us what we have always known, that everything here is transitory. This is just a little more obvious statement of it. Also, that each individual must gain a philosophy of life that is stronger than death. That death cannot be regarded as any longer either a nuisance or an interference. It must be regarded with some of the same concept of understanding that Walt Whitman had when he wrote a beautiful poem to death. Death is a friend because in many ways it consummates the various activities of life. It breaks up patterns that could not otherwise be broken. It releases individuals from cycles in which they can no longer release themselves. It moves the individual out of situations back into universal opportunity so that he may redirect his courses according to his insight. These changes are not disasters. They are part of the eternal life of things, of which transition is merely an appearance. Suns, moons, planets die. Everything passes from an active to a passive state. Everything is objective and then subjective. These tides are forever turning in the universe. Our main concern is that when men interfere with this tidal rhythm, suddenly death becomes a terrible thing because it is apparently caused by so terrible and horrible an instrument. But regardless of what causes it, it is the same. Regardless of what it is, each person must rise above it by an experience of his own consciousness. One of the Greeks said that all men in this world live for one reason, and that reason is that they shall learn how to die. There's a lot of wisdom in that, because death is one of the most honorable, the most magnificent experiences of life. It consummates life even more than does birth. And there is no episode between the birth and death that more gallantly calls upon all that we are, or more perfectly reveals both our strength and our weakness. So that in this issue, we can move with a certain contentment, even in an atomic age, fully aware that nothing can happen to us that is not right. And that if it is right that this should happen, then it is because there is an end beyond far greater. That this is only an appearance, but that the substance behind this appearance is eternal good and eternal love, ever moving. It is always easy to see love in those who do things to please us, but we must also learn to see love in the wisdom of heaven that does that which is best. This is our understanding. This is what philosophy does for us. And this is how we can take philosophy and apply it to the problem of this time. And if we can apply it well, we shall achieve more than one end. We shall not only attain a quietude, a gracious acceptance of inevitables, which is the most important conservation of energy possible to us. But we will set a good example to a world that is shaken and rather sick about it all. For in these times, it is important that philosophy shall enable us to walk upon the surface of the ocean and say unto the waves, be still. This walking upon the ocean is man's ability to walk quietly across the surface of eternal change, unaffected by it. That the individual has the power to say to the tempest, be still. He also has the power to say to his own heart, be still and know. These are important discoveries. And we probably would have been 500 years slower in attaining them had not our scientific skill suddenly brought this crisis upon our world. We were headed that direction for a long time, but suddenly it happened. And like all emergencies, we are not always prepared when they happen, even though we know they will come. But this emergency is also our great opportunity, where it suddenly brings home to us the importance of all the neglected areas of knowledge, the wonders of religion, the beauties and truths of philosophy. It also causes us to come into great and clear insight into the true wonders of science and how this particular thing is also the shadow of the good that man could do if he could turn his ingenuity to the service of his neighbor rather than to the destruction of an enemy. But we have learned that now that science can explore far into the mystery of life, and that can also make great and good discoveries if its conscience and its heart will lead it in the right direction. We are recognizing that we live in a world of powers that we never knew before, and we now must adjust to the right action of these powers. Part of the Bushido, or great code of the Japanese gentleman, used to be that a samurai carried a sword. And as Prince Toku said, the sword is a weapon, and it is a test of character. The gentleman will draw his sword to protect his honor, or to protect the honor of others. But the strong man is the one who wears the sword, but is too wise to draw it. He is stronger if he wears the sword, because then the temptation to draw it is more real. But his great virtue lies that holding it in his hand, he will not use it. Long ago, perhaps, Shotoku Taishi sensed something. Today, we hold in our hand a weapon far more keen than the sharp, curved blade of the samurai. If we are a gentleman, if we are wise, if we are honorable, we will use it to protect the good and to protect honor. But if we are still wiser, we will use this weapon as a symbol that we can hold it and not use it. And this is the symbol of our own self-control. And today we need that self-control. Never before have we had as great an opportunity to be good. For never before have we had such a ready means of being evil. So if we can hold this tremendous discovery in our hands, but be too wise to ever use it, we may gain a lesson that thousands of previous years have never been able to teach us. So we have to face these lessons, and we have to face the life that they bring. And in this time, realize that we were not left alone in our extremity, like poor old Cardinal Wolsey. We are not left alone. We have been provided with all the means of insight that we have ever needed. We have available to us all instruction, all insight, all inspiration of beauty, truth, love, art, literature, ethics, and culture. These things are all available to us. The solutions are available and are at hand. We only need to reach out and take them. And the thing that must cause us to reach out is this something within ourselves that, waking to the seriousness of the occasion, chooses at this time to make the simple decision of right action. If this is accomplished, tragedy may well be averted. But if it cannot be averted, it will be a tragedy only to those who do not understand. The rest will accept it, face it, move through it to the eternal victory that is the inevitable birthright of the human soul. Well, time is up, I think, for this evening. Thank you.